Some time ago, I took a retreat for clergy in the north of England. And during the course of the retreat, I suppose I saw every priest who was taking part privately. And again, in different ways, the statement was made, I don't pray very much now, I don't meditate, I'm muddled about the whole matter. Well, there's a great deal of muddle today over the subject of meditation and prayer. So I want to try and I want to ask you to look at this subject and look at it with, in some detail and systematically, because of the commonly held misunderstandings about the subject. Let us first of all examine the word itself, and let us turn to the Oxford Dictionary. That's nice and safe and sound, isn't it? Well, the Oxford Dictionary gives two definitions of the meaning of the word. The first is to plan mentally and exercise the mind. That's the first definition of the word meditation, to plan mentally and to exercise the mind. The second definition is that of contemplation upon a subject. Now, I shall develop this a little later on. But first of all, it is very important to grasp the distinction between these two. That is, the difference between a mental exercise involving the mind and contemplation involving another faculty, a faculty other than the brain. The first of these two activities may be described as reflective meditation, and the second as contemplative meditation. Now, I say it's important to grasp the difference between the two because in the Western Christian tradition, apart from the experience of the mystics, the word meditation has almost exclusively been equated with the first definition. That is, an activity of the brain. So when the average Christian in the past, if there ever have been average Christians, yes, we won't go into that, the average Christian uses the word meditation, he means an activity of the brain. Today's popular use of the word, its meaning has been identified with the second aspect, which the Christian mystics have called contemplative meditation, or simply contemplative prayer. Now, it's a curious anomaly to confuse the issue a little further, that amongst the religious orders of the Christian Church, both Anglican and Roman Catholic, those which have been called contemplative orders have, on the whole, emphasized the first aspect of meditation and frequently practiced reflective meditation under the name of contemplation. Now, the reason for this, I suggest, is the traditional preoccupation in the Christian Church with the objects of contemplation, rather than with understanding the faculty by which such contemplation becomes possible. For such understanding largely disappeared from Christianity with the eradication of all forms of gnosis or knowledge, incidentally, one of the gifts of the Spirit. In the early days of the Christian Church, there was a terrible fear of Gnosticism. Gnosticism to do with the Greek word gnosis or knowledge. And the Gnostics were hounded out as heretics. And even today, if you use the word gnosis or Gnosticism to the average Anglican priest or Christian minister, into his eyes will come a glazed look, because he remembers that as a theological student, for 2 or 3 years he was warned against Gnosticism and anyone who professed gnosis. So I suggest this as one of the reasons why there has been this confusion, even within the religious orders of the Christian Church. Now, we are today experiencing in the West a very great interest in contemplative meditation. And I would like to suggest some of the reasons for this. There is, first of all, a fairly superficial reason. That is the intermingling of the cultures of East and West, an aspect of immigration that Mr. Enoch Powell has never really dealt with. A phenomenon that has developed so markedly in this country since the last war. Now, in the East, the contemplative approach to religion, indeed the contemplative approach to life, has always been predominant, often to the exclusion of everything else. And in recent years, the influence of Eastern thought upon Western culture and religion has been very considerable. Nevertheless, this in itself is not sufficient to explain the very great movement or shift in religious consciousness that is now taking place in this country. For such a change could only take place if the influences which have flooded in from the East found a resonance or response in Western man. And without doubt, this is the case, especially amongst the young. Now, why is this? May we look in some detail at the change of consciousness to which I have referred and the factors it involves. I quote now from Happold's other book, Religious Faith and 20th Century Man. And this is what he says. Something is happening in the world. We are conscious of it all around us. Our era is said to be the era of secular man, man come of age, who no longer has need of God. This may be true, but may it not also be that we are in the midst, or should we say on the verge, of one of those mental and spiritual leaps which have happened before in the history of mankind. Eras when the corporate mentality and spirituality of man shift and expand, and new vistas and interpretations of the universe open up. He then goes on to suggest that in this leap epoch of human evolution, in which consciousness is now passing onto a new level of awareness and insight, the only acceptable religion is likely to be a mystical one. Mystical in the sense of experimental wisdom. Now, there's a great deal of loose thinking and talking today about mysticism. Mysticism is not psychism. They are fundamentally different. But we'll come on to that later on. The question we must now ask is there any evidence of this today within the Christian Church? I believe there is a very great deal of evidence. During the past 25 years, concepts of God have undergone a very remarkable change. When Bishop Robinson, in his book Honest to God, put forward the proposition of God as the ground of our being, this, and I think this is very important, did not tell people something they did not know or that was strange and alien to them. It simply articulated for a great many people that which for many years they had intuitively known to be true. It took the lid off the religious situation and marked the great conscious transition in this country from a concept of God as over and above and outside the created order, that is, a transcendental God, to a God who is within and who permeates the whole of the created order, that is, an immanent God. Now, both these aspects or understanding of the nature of God have always been inherent in the Christian faith. Both aspects, without doubt, permeate the New Testament writings. Nevertheless, with the exception of the experience of the mystics, the predominant aspect, the aspect which has largely shaped Christian thinking and theology and determined Christian experience, has been that of a God who is transcendent. And this, of course, has been the great factor influencing both the corporate and individual prayer life of the church. A God who is taught, thought, and subsequently felt in all respects to be apart from and above his creatures, will have, inevitably, as his devotees, distant supplicants overwhelmed with their separateness and their sinfulness. And this has been the result of an overemphasis on the transcendence of God and an exclusion of his immanence. But a great change, as I say, is now profoundly affecting the prayer life of many people. And the results of this are only just beginning to be felt. There is coming to birth in our very midst a new awareness of the God who indwells the whole of the created order. And for Christians, the beginning of a new understanding of the great Pauline teaching of the Christ within. Devotionalism in the church is giving way, very, very gradually, but most certainly giving way to an interior awareness. And this great change within man's consciousness is now throwing fresh light on some of the great passages in St. Paul's letter to the Christians at Colossae and to the Christians at Ephesus, the letters to the Colossians and the Ephesians. Because of this, there is now a great intuitive longing and searching for spiritual disciplines which train people to give space to the God within. That is, to the disciplines of contemplative meditation. Everywhere one looks within the various churches and outside, individuals and groups are to be found within many and diverse doctrinal frameworks and none, who are searching intuitively for new ways of prayer. And here may I briefly refer to something that relates very much to this movement towards the contemplative. That is, the relationship between science and meditation. Reflective meditation, here we are back at the definitions, reflective meditation may be linked to the Western scientific method, which is a method of analysis and dissection. Whereas contemplative meditation or contemplative prayer relates to the method of Eastern science, which is not to analyze and dissect in order to touch reality, but to develop an awareness of the whole and the interrelationship of all things. I'd like to quote now from a book of Sufi essays by a man named Syed Hossein Nasser, and from his essay on ecology. And here he refers to Eastern science. Before everything else, it is essential to clarify what is meant by Eastern science. For our purpose here, it means the sciences of the great traditions of Asia, especially the Chinese and Japanese, the Indian and the Islamic. By extension, this term could embrace other traditional sciences, but it is sufficient here to limit ourselves to the cases cited above. Although far from being identical in themselves, these sciences share a fundamental principle in common, which is to regard the science of nature in the light of metaphysical principles, or from another point of view, to study nature as a domain, and here it comes, that is contained and embraced by a supra-sensible world that is immensely greater than it. To be aware of the reality behind that which is visible. And then he makes a very interesting comment here. The sense of pride that has accompanied the particular type of mental activity in the West called modern science is such that it relegates anything that does not conform to its view of what true science should be to the realm of pseudoscience. Now, this I think is very important. That is why today so many things which are left out of the official scientific view in the West are creeping up in the form of occult sciences, against whose rise modern science has no power at all. Now, there is evidence today to suggest that Western scientists are beginning to recognize the significance of what has all hitherto been called the pseudo-scientific method of the East. And with this, we are witnessing an extraordinary coming together of science and religion. The scientist and the mystic are seen to be moving in the same direction. And it is not without significance that today, conferences and seminars arranged to bring these two worlds together are evoking immense interest and support. Contemplative meditation is very much more than a way of saying my prayers. It is a whole philosophy of life. Indeed, it is a science. It affects and influences our understanding of the whole of life, the whole of the created order, with its kingdoms, mineral, vegetable, animal, and human. It brings a new awareness of the nature of God, and to this new awareness it relates the life of prayer and meditation. It sees no dichotomy between the development of spirituality and a passionate ecological concern. Indeed, the prayer life that issues from this new understanding brings us, in the words of Teilhard de Chardin, to the very heart of the universe and to the world of economics. This is not Teilhard, this is me. The world of economics, politics, education, and science. It is no escapism into a world of fantasy and unreality. Now, may we look at the spiritual path which can lead to such a contemplative understanding of life. As individuals, and we have to do this as individuals, first and foremost, as individuals travel along the path of spiritual development and evolution, they may move into and through differing levels of operation and understanding. For many today, the path is one which begins with the conventional, leads on through the charismatic, and then into the contemplative. Now, I'd like to give some clear definition, if I can, to these terms. First of all, conventionalism and the charismatic. By conventionalism is meant mechanical, behavioral patterns, social, cultural, or religious. Mechanical behavior patterns, social, cultural, or religious. Such patterns of behavior result from the crystallization into static form of a particular creative energy or force. The force having manifested at a particular time, in a particular situation, fulfilling a particular need. The resulting behavior pattern, when reproduced in other situations and mechanically followed, becomes conventionalism. That is what we mean by conventionalism, social, cultural, or religious. Today, there are the religious conventionalisms which have been with us for a very long time. Christian and ecclesiastical behavioral patterns divorced from the energy from which they took their origin. But beware, new ones are already forming. Conventionalism is as inherent in Aquarian as in Piscean thought forms. Man has not yet evolved to the point beyond the possibility of New Age conventionalism, and we're beginning to see it crystallizing all around us. Mechanical, behavioral, and thought patterns are produced and perpetuated by mechanical man. And a mechanical man with a new set of ideas is still a mechanical man or woman. New ideas are not to be equated with a new level of operation. Indeed, the absorption of such new ideas may become the great substitute for transformation, as men such as Gurdjieff and long before him, John Law, the English mystic, were so aware. John Law, the great English mystic, wrote to John Wesley, who initiated the great evangelical revival in this country and probably saved England from a revolution. He wrote to him and warned him.
and said the head can play with ideas about the heart, just as it can play with any other old-fashioned ideas. So you can just let one set of ideas go and another set of ideas come in, all on the same level of operation. And so instead of going around propagating the old things, you start propagating new things, just as ideas, nothing more. To step out from such mechanical behavior is a first step in a true spiritual pilgrimage. So much for conventionalism. Now let us look at the much abused and misunderstood word charismatic, much used in Tunbridge Wells. The origin of the word is simple enough. The Greek word charisma, as used in the New Testament, means a special and powerful additional supernormal capacity. It is therefore an added dimension to ordinary human capacity and experience. The opening up within the human psyche of a channel of energy manifesting in a diversity of psychic powers with different individuals. And remember that the psychic is nothing to do with the spiritual. It is to do with man's natural human potential. And although such a manifestation of psychic energy may run parallel to, or in the context of, a true spiritual experience, the psychic and the spiritual are fundamentally different. In common parlance today, the word is used to describe public figures who evidence a particular kind of magnetism. It is also commonly used today to describe the contemporary revival which is taking place within the Christian Church, a revival of the psychic gifts described by St. Paul in his letter to the Christians at Corinth. The opening up of this channel of energy resulting today within the Church in powers of healing, tongues, that is glossolalia, ecstatic utterance, prophecy and clairvoyant faculties. To follow the charismatic path is therefore to tread the path of power, either within or outside the Christian Church. And the path of power, if it is, as invariably it does, if it becomes an end in itself, and is divorced from agape, the highest form of love. You know, the word love in the New Testament is used for different meanings. Agape is the highest form of love. Philios is brotherly love, and eros is secular love. And there's a great deal of confusion and woolly thinking today about love. Provided people can throw their arms around one another and have glistening eyes, they're thought to have agape. It's very often hovering between philios and eros. And this is where discernment is necessary. Nothing wrong with the other two, but let's be clear which level we're operating on. It becomes a cul-de-sac, the path of power, of glamour, egocentricity, and delusion. As St. Paul so clearly warned, and as the lives of those caught up in this particular energy, both inside and outside of the church, so frequently testify. The path of power must lead to the more excellent way described by St. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, for those who have their Bibles with them, the way of the heart, or the contemplative path. So we're back now to contemplative prayer. I've described, or tried to describe, the stage of conventionalism, the stage of commonly called charismatic, the way of power, and then to come on to the contemplative way. Remember that each stage is valid, each phase has its place. Indeed, the movement forward is part of growing up into Christ. And the movement from one stage to the next does not imply repudiation of the value of the former, because often you couldn't be where you are now unless you've been through what you went through before, if you see what I mean. And remember that in the evolution of spiritual life, there is the recurring sequence of chrysalis and butterfly. And we don't clearly go from one to another, through that and to the other, because they run parallel. There's always a danger of lapsing into conventionalism. There's always a danger of gravitating to the path of power. So we need to keep correcting ourselves. What is important is to recognize when the time has come to move forward, when to initiate the process of breaking down the conditioning which builds around a particular stage, a conditioning which leads us into conventionalism, and how to recognize the dynamic which will lead us forward. And of course, movement forward is never easy, for spiritual evolution goes against all the gravitational pulls of conventionalism and psychic excitement. We need also to recognize the developing awareness within which indicates when the time is ripe for moving on. And in this connection, beware of labels, old age or new age, Piscean or Aquarian, that anchor you to a particular place or static cultic form. This doesn't mean to say you skip out of responsible situations all the time. We don't. Now, if we have reached the point of an inner desire to know from the heart, to develop this faculty for contemplation, what do we do? Well, to learn about meditation does not necessarily lead to, nor indeed provide an incentive for meditating. This may simply create another pattern of belief about meditation. If we have found the desire to begin the meditative path, that is to bring into discipline the inner faculties which are given to us for hearing, seeing, and knowing, then we have begun already to tread the path which leads towards heart wisdom or knowledge. Now, just a word about the difference between knowledge and belief. Belief is quite distinct from knowledge. A pattern of belief may be the framework within which you will have to work, or I will have to work. And the churches provide, and the religions provide, patterns of belief. And for many people today, it is still very necessary to have a framework within which to work. Knowledge is that which comes, or wisdom is that which comes from the awakening of the heart faculty. And it is the hallmark of the spiritually mature that he or she does not feel impelled to put others right with regards to their beliefs. A set of beliefs is useful insofar as it provides a framework for growth. When it becomes a prison or a wall between people, then is the time to attend to its demolition, but the demolition of your own, not somebody else's. That can be very, very hurtful and indeed destructive. It is not our business to dismantle anything. I'll stop there. Now, it is frequently asserted that the one who meditates is retreating from the realities of life. The reverse is true. The awakened heart can encompass the whole universe, and the secrets of the universe are revealed to the one who will tread this path. For with the awakening of the heart faculty comes the awakening of the inner eye, and a perception is born which has to do with the whole of life. And this is nothing whatever to do with the third eye. There are far, far too many people today involved in so-called meditation groups which center them here. And this can be dangerous and lead to delusion. The third eye is something quite distinct from the eye which I'm talking about today, the eye of the heart, and which St. Paul had, strangely enough, quite a lot to say about in his letters. This is why this is called the Christ Center, because it's the center with which the writings of the New Testament are concerned. And at that stage of man's evolution, this is what the Christ came to manifest. It is probable that we cannot all have this perception to the same degree, but we can all have it. It will manifest itself in different degrees and to different intensities with different individuals. It is a perception which ranges from the true seeing of other people to a perception of reality behind the whole of life. It perceives that no man is an island and that aloneness is an illusion which belongs to the pseudo-self or ego. It is a perception which, where highly developed, sees much of what the scientist sees, and in some respects even more. For it perceives not only the unity of energy which holds all creation together, but goes on to an awareness that this energy is personal and that it is love. And this is the way in to union with God for an increasing number of people today. They cannot come the traditional way, it is not their way. They come fresh out from outside of the traditional forms. But there is today a deep awareness amongst many people outside of the church of this unity of energy and an awareness that it is personal. And this is what Teilhard de Chardin called the new Christ consciousness, which is now arising on every hand. I came across somebody very kindly and anonymously at Burswood, gave me a book, which I value enormously, an album of Teilhard de Chardin, and I was very thrilled when I looked at a picture in this book of the Sussex countryside with a quotation from Teilhard, and I'll read it to you. It says, during this period, Teilhard de Chardin began to see the universe in its oneness. And he said, I can remember the extraordinary experience I saw in the English countryside. I had in the English countryside about that time, at sunset in particular, when the Sussex woods seemed to be charged with all the fossil life that I was then looking for, from cliffs to quarries and in the clays of the weald. Sometimes it really seemed to me as though suddenly some sort of universal being was about to take on shape in nature before my very eyes in Sussex. And that's lovely. And this, if it isn't to do with the second coming, then I don't know what it is to do with. This perception, therefore, gives birth to compassion. And once we have perceived just a little, just a glimpse of these things, there follows a reverence for the whole of life. Plant, animal, human. And this may then lead us to the great prologue in St. John's Gospel, the first chapter, with new seeing, new hearing, and new understanding. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. All things were made by him. Without him was not anything made that was made. In him was the life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not. And so on, until we come to St. John the Baptist, and it's his day today. Embodied in this reverence for life is another perception. It is that of the Christ struggling to come to birth in so many, indeed in the whole of creation. As Vera Stanley Alder in one of her books says, as man evolves into the next stage of his development, the heart will become a thinking, creative medium. And the essence of the Christian gospel is about the possibility of man taking control of the evolutionary process and putting it into operation within a lifespan. That is why the New Testament has nothing to say about reincarnation. Because this was not the concern of Jesus. The Buddha refused to speculate about the afterlife. He would never talk about the afterlife. That was not his concern. It detracted from the mission that he had. And Jesus had nothing to say about reincarnation, and you can juggle with texts as much as you like in the New Testament, but the New Testament has nothing specific to say about reincarnation. Because It was the concern of Jesus to reveal this tremendous reality that there is a possibility in one lifespan of breaking through into full realization of the true self, the possibility. And once you get away from this and go into speculating as to what you're going to do next time you come round and what you may have done last time you came round, well, you get away from the center point. I want to close by reading from, if I can find it, the Michael office, which we use daily at Kent House in the Michael Chapel. Michael the Archangel has been called the light bearer for the Christ. Perhaps I can give that some definition. Michael is the personification of the energies of light or enlightenment. The Christ energies, as revealed in Jesus, are the energies of love. So Michael is the personification of light in this sense. Jesus is the personification of love. So Michael is the light bearer for the second coming of the Christ. And what is happening now is that enlightenment is pouring in to the human psyche, inside and outside of the church. So this is the age of Michael, the archangel. And he is preparing the way for that which is even now beginning to happen, the second coming. Michael the archangel has been called the light bearer for the Christ. The aim of the Michael link is to unite us in Christ through a daily offering of the Michael office and the meditation at 6 p.m. to so creating a link between those striving to move forward with wholeness and Christ-centeredness into the new age. Now, the form of the meditation is contemplative. It is therefore a disciplined awareness from the heart of the energies of Christ's light, love, and power, now struggling to come to birth within the hearts of men and all creation, a realization of the truth as it is in Jesus. In developing this awareness, we open ourselves, contemporary society, and all created orders to the Christ who is coming in glory. Then it goes on to say that members of the link are encouraged to express their meditative awareness in some specific form of service to suffering humanity and to the planet so exploited by man. What is desperately needed, I believe, in the present situation is a combination of esoteric understanding with an awakening social consciousness. And so often the two get divorced. Those who are concerned with esoteric studies and awareness forget all about social responsibility in society, and often those who are deeply involved in social movements simply don't have time to be aware of that which must be the source of all powerful and fruitful social activity. I suggest we stay where we are and spend a short time in reflective meditation, that is, quietly thinking over anything which may seem to be of value. That which doesn't seem to be of value, forget it, if you haven't already forgotten it anyway. Any point or line of thought that does ring a bell with you, if it does, then just meditate on it. Think quietly about it, and then for a short time we will go into a period of contemplative meditation.